Welcome, folks, to the MCrit podcast. This is the first ever MCrit book club, and this is on the topic of the mind of the resuscitationist. Now, who would I grab for an MCrit book club on the topic of the mind of the resuscitation except for my friend, the Resus Me creator, and now Rage podcaster, Cliff Reed. Cliff, say hello to the folks.
Hello, everyone.
Cliff, I was so happy when you agreed to do this because you were the person I actually wanted to talk about all the things that went on in my mind as I was reading this book. And what did you think of it in general?
Well, I have to say thank you for recommending it. The book blew me away. There are so many nuggets, so much wisdom in there that we can apply to our resuscitation practice. So thanks for inviting me here to talk about it.
Oh, no, it's a great pleasure. And just for people who have never come across the book, this is basically by a retired soldier who went back and did a PhD in psychology. And he talks about the mindset, the physiologic processes that go on for elite soldiers. And as I was reading this, I first read it years ago and then reread it for this book club, it just struck me with amazing clarity how much this is directly applicable to our job in the ED or the pre-hospital environment or the critical care unit. Did you find that as well, Cliff?
I did. And in some ways, it's close to home for me because I've been involved in martial arts for many years. 28 years, I calculated this morning. And I found lots of overlap in how we prepare in that training for unarmed combat and how we prepare for resuscitation. And so it really did strike a chord with me on that sort of combat level.
Definitely. And basically, for the rest of this book club, you could just substitute resuscitation for combat, and pretty much everything else written in that book will fit with our lives. So I think the entire book is worth reading, Cliff, but we zoned in on just a few areas just for the sake of brevity. And we're just going to go through it in the order it's in the book. And the first chapter we're going to talk about is the stress responses to combat. And they make very clear in this chapter that it is not just within the realm of possibility, but almost the norm in the very beginning of a major conflict to lose bowel and bladder control. And did this strike a chord with you, Cliff?
It did. I think it's really important to acknowledge that you can lose control of these autonomic functions. And I think the author puts it really well in terms of reassuring people that may lose control. And there's some beautiful wording, too, as well. They talk about redirecting their assets, which referred to one soldier, you know, essentially peeing in his pants in combat. And that if it happens to you, that's a normal response. It's not abnormal. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's something to acknowledge and perhaps prepare for.
Absolutely. And now these same autonomic responses are why people do faint their first time in an anatomy lab or in the operating room or doing their first central line, which seems to be a common theme in our residency. And people should not feel bad. This is just the natural way your body was built. And I don't know if we've had anyone in our training program who has lost bladder or bowel control, but if they do, it's a natural response. They shouldn't feel bad.
And you can prepare yourself in some ways. So in our service, we have this mantra, full stomach, empty bladder, when preparing for a pre-hospital mission. It's not really because we're concerned people are going to pee themselves. It's more so they're not distracted by a full bladder on scene. But certainly if you know something's about to kick off in terms of a resuscitation, it makes sense not to have to worry about these things. And in fact, Scott, I'll admit I was a little anxious about speaking to you before the audience today. So I did actually go for what the author describes as a battle crap before we started recording.
Hopefully you made it to the bathroom, my friend.
Yep, all good. Done and dusted, dude.
All right. Now, that's all we're going to say about chapter two. Chapter three, things start getting more interesting. This is the body's sympathetic and parasympathetic responses to combat and conflict. And I think this stuff's directly applicable to the ED. Why don't you talk first about parasympathetic backlash, Cliff?
Yeah, this is a really interesting phenomenon that I've witnessed in teams and experienced myself. And this is the follow-on from the adrenal surge that you get during the actual resuscitation. Afterwards, when things calm down, there's this backlash, a parasympathetic drive. And a good example I find is you've got a difficult intubation. The airway is secured, and at that moment, there's a collective sigh of relief within the team. Faces become a little flushed. There's some humor, and the pace changes, the atmosphere changes, and we've gone from sympathetic to parasympathetic mode because of this reassurance and this battle's over sort of feeling. And that's actually something to be mindful of, be aware of, because it could be a danger to the patient. For example, I've seen teams forget to then squeeze the bag or forget to sedate the patient adequately or analgesize the patient. So if we're aware of it, we can look out for it and we can take steps to mitigate the effects.
Absolutely. In fact, I have a quote that's fantastic from Napoleon. The moment of greatest vulnerability is the instant immediately after victory. And that's just what you just said, Cliff. I would take this phenomenon one step further and say that I actually have a physical manifestation of this anytime I've done a major resuscitation where my adrenals have been pounding. And immediately following it, I am near dead. My back starts hurting. I walk stooped over. I need to sit down. And I've had this be consistently what happens after every major resus. And it's just because your body, as soon as you relax, basically shuts down. And if you have another resus come in at that moment, it's a bad situation.
I agree. And that's something we experience in the field in pre-hospital care. A particularly harrowing scene with a very sick patient and things are full on during that resuscitation. And that moment of handover in the emergency department is where you do really want to just curl up into a ball and go to sleep. But you have to get yourself prepared for the next one, of course.
Definitely. Now, they have some means to counter this. When I was doing my martial arts training, we were always advocated, as soon as you've defeated an opponent, you do a 360-degree sweep and keep absolute awareness at that moment because it's the second attacker that you're going to miss. Did you get the same during your martial arts training, Cliff?
Yeah, absolutely. It's that point when you've taken someone down, you're finishing them off on the floor where their mates come in and kick you in the head. So yeah, it's back on your feet, the 360-degree sweep, and get physically and cognitively ready.
And now they go further and they discuss SWAT teams, and they have an acronym for SWAT teams after the conclusion of a operation, which is LACE, L-A-C-E, liquids, ammunition, casualties, and equipment. And the way I translated that for resuscitation, and it doesn't unfortunately have a nice acronym, maybe someone will come up for it in the audience, is check your team, make sure no one's been hurt and everyone's okay. Reset your resuscitation bay. Put all the equipment back so that if there is another patient coming in the next 5 minutes, you're ready to go. Drink something and then debrief your team.
Yeah, I really like that. And that parallels something we've been developing at Sydney HEMS, which is a post-intubation checklist before leaving the scene. Because we've drilled the hell out of pre-hospital rapid sequence intubation with simulation and with checklists. And what we then found the weakness, if you like, to be was this potential parasympathetic backlash and a loss of mission momentum at that point. And so, bang, the tubes in, the capnography is confirmed. We now have a checklist to go through immediately afterwards to get things ready for the next stage of the mission.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. Now, the converse to this, because the parasympathetic backlash happens when you've had a long period of adrenal surge. Now, on the other hand, there can be situations where you get a huge spike of catecholamines in your system, but then whatever caused them is now gone, and you're left with those catecholamines just sitting there. The examples used in the book are a brief five-second altercation with a patrol officer or a gunfight where there's just one shot, but they still are incredibly revved up, and that's also a dangerous situation for the opposite reason. You have all this adrenal catechol surging through your system and nowhere for it to go. And one example that I put for this in the hospital is you are talking to a colleague and you get into an altercation, an argument, and then they just walk away from you. And now for the next half hour of your shift, you're left with all this stress and all these hormones and nothing to do with it. And you had another example as well, Cliff, right?
Yeah, a couple of examples. So one is you've just referred a patient and your colleague on the phone for some reason has been extremely condescending and rude to you. And I find that when I put the phone down, my heart's pounding. It feels like it wants to burst out of my chest. And I've got this adrenal surge that I have to do something with. And this can also apply to a team. So, for example, you get an ambulance alert that they're bringing in a sick patient. Your team is ready. You've checked your kit. You've psyched yourselves up, talked through the potential plan. And then you get another call to say they've diverted to another hospital. And you've got this collective adrenaline surge in the room. and you need to discharge it. It makes me think about you've charged a defib to shock someone and then they've spontaneously reverted. So you have to dump that charge. So we've got to work out a safe, effective way of dumping this adrenal charge for ourselves and for the team.
Absolutely. Now, in the book, they just suggest that you should just run a couple miles, and I think that would work great. Unfortunately, it's not applicable when you're on the job. Have you brainstormed any solutions, Cliff?
Not really. I think something physical to dump the adrenaline, so some kind of physical activity. And in the example of the diverted patient, you're there around the bed. You could run a quick sim just so the team have something to do with that energy.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love that. I'm going to use that. I think also it would be great to have a punching bag in the tea room.
Yep. In fact, in my office in the UK, when I worked as an emergency physician there, I had one in my office, a thing called a Barber body opponent bag. Came in very handy. Sometimes on a bad day, there was a queue to use him.
Now, the last thing in this chapter, which I think has some relevance to us, is all the problems of sleep deprivation. And now this is obvious to anyone who practices in emergency medicine, but the author makes the point that caffeine can be your friend when used as a medication. Nicotine, not so much. Now, I've never smoked tobacco, so I have no ability to comment on this. Cliff, what about you?
Same here. I've never smoked tobacco. We get through a lot of coffee on the base. But I think the way we should really be thinking about this as individuals and as organizations is have a fatigue management policy. You know, it's one thing to have to cope with exhaustion and fatigue, but if you can take steps to prevent that happening in the first place or have a plan to manage the absence of a fatigued colleague, being grown up enough and safe enough to say, look, I'm too tired for the next mission, can someone stand in? That's really the way we should be going. It's the way the airline industry works, and it's one of the things we can take from that profession.
Perfect. So, Cliff, now we're going to go to chapter 4, and this actually describes a set of conditions predicated on where your stress systems are, how far you are into fear or stress-induced badness in your own physiologic systems. Now, Grossman describes heart rate ranges, and he's clear about a couple things. First of all, the ranges we're going to discuss are not absolute for every person. They're just generality. And second of all, it's not the same thing for you to have a heart rate from running around the block and then having to do something like perform a procedure, as opposed to your own fear responses getting you to that heart rate. So with those two provisos being understood, he describes three basic zones of stress-induced physiology. And there's the yellow zone, general fear-induced heart rate of 90 to 120. And that's the zone where you can still perform fine motor skills. Past that, you can't. Things like central lines, procedures involving scalpel. He discusses the red zone, which is in general a heart rate of 120 to 150, where it may be the optimal point for strength-related actions, but beyond this zone, you lose complex motor skills, meaning anything that requires more than just one thing. So you could slam your shoulder against the door in this zone probably better than any other point, but you can't slam your shoulder and then do a head tuck roll into there unless you've trained on it extensively. And then a black zone, greater than a heart rate of 150, where all sorts of horror starts happening. You don't see well, you can't function, you can't perform tasks, you may have that bowel or bladder loss we were talking about. Cliff, do you think there's applicability to this stuff for resuscitation?
I do. I like the coloring of the zones and the concepts that this conveys. And it really is important to recognize that as stress increases, the effect on different aspects of our performance becomes more marked, and there will be a point at which your fine motor skills will deteriorate. I like this concept of the condition black, where you lose all useful function. And this reminded me to mention that when people learn about adrenal responses and a stress reaction, it's often taught in terms of fight or flight, isn't it? You know, your adrenaline powers you up so you can run away or fight. But they're forgetting a third one that often happens, which is freezing. And really, it's fight, flight, or freeze response. And unless you're trained, unless your head's in the right space, one effect of this adrenaline surge is to absolutely freeze. And when you get into condition black, that's when you cease to function and you can freeze.
Absolutely. And he actually points out that you could look at people and know when they're verging towards that black, because fear or stress-induced heart rate increases actually go along with a peripheral vasoconstriction, while exercise-induced heart rate changes, you're actually going to be a vasodilator in your periphery. So if you see one of your trainees or one of your colleagues start getting their hands white and maybe their perioral areas white, they're not doing so well. And they probably need to be taken out of the game or coached as to what they should be doing to fix that condition.
Hey, do you know, I saw the effect of this very early on in when I started doing pre-hospital care for the London Helicopter Emergency Medical Service. We went to this, what in retrospect was a fantastic job, not so great for the patients. But what happened was a double-decker London bus lost control because the driver had a seizure, and they went over a bridge and fell several meters, and the bus hit the ground head first and ended up almost embedded in the ground at a 45 degree angle. So the nose of the bus was in the ground. The back of the bus was sticking up at this elevated bridge. And there were several patients in the bus with minor injuries. And there was an unconscious driver. We didn't know at the time he'd had a seizure, so we assumed he was unconscious from the trauma. But there are huge scene safety implications here. And the guy who's in charge of the scene is the senior fire officer. So I go there and I want to speak to him about whether it's safe to approach and any issues that he needs to inform me of before we discuss the medical aspects. And this guy is exactly as you describe. He's pale, he's staring, pupils dilated, and he doesn't respond to me. It's really strange. He's staring straight ahead. He's not actually fixing on anything in terms of his gaze. And he's ignoring me, and I'm speaking to him, excuse me, sir, and I actually have to shake this guy, who's a lot bigger than me, physically shake him, and then you can see him refocus and actually notice that I was there, but he still wasn't in a condition to discuss anything sensibly. I think this guy was out of his depth, showing condition black.
Absolutely. I see people verging on condition black, and certain specialties, and we won't discuss them, actually manifest when they get to near this point as being very belligerent. And Cliff, I think you've taught me this in your lectures, is to have some sympathy for those folks. And what might be happening is they're manifesting an incredible degree of stress response by being very directive and saying things that we don't necessarily agree with. And it's very easy to get them even more revved up by fighting with them, when what maybe we should be saying is, let's all step back and reconsider this situation and just really giving them some space to bring their heart rate down and get back out of it. I know you talk about this all the time in your lectures, Cliff. Have you noticed that belligerence may be manifesting a stress response?
I think so. It's been described in some sources as a cognitive emergency reaction, where they're out of their depth and they're in perhaps this black zone, and they're trying to claw back a feeling of control. And they'll do that by being more aggressive, by being dominant sometimes, and trying to just reassert themselves. And they will manipulate their reality to give them a sense of control. So they'll ignore some realities about the patient's status, pretend things are going a different way, suggest an intervention that they are comfortable with that the patient doesn't need or might have an adverse consequence. And I completely agree with you. We don't meet that head on and get them more revved up. We give them a chance to step back, use a yes and approach, thank them for their input, and just give them that breathing space.
Now, the author has a fantastic quote for this as well, from Othello by Shakespeare. "I understand a fury in your words, but not the words." And I just love that so much.
I love that. There are so many great quotes in this book. That's superb.
Now, we've discussed these conditions. We haven't necessarily discussed ways of making our trainees immune or at least resistant to the problems of these conditions. And from reading this book again, I will make the contention that we are utterly wasting our high fidelity simulation opportunities, which don't happen that often. And we're using them for silly stuff like actual medical procedures, when low fidelity sim may be just fine for that. I think where high fidelity sim can have an enormous benefit is not teaching people how to perform a chest tube, but instead teaching them stress inoculation. Cliff, what do you think?
I completely agree. And you and I have discussed these concepts before in terms of getting cognitive fidelity, at least as much as the physical fidelity. And I love the term stress inoculation. What a beautiful phrase. And what I found interesting in this book was the suggestion that there was some kind of transferability of stress inoculation. And so if you train to do one thing under stress, then you'll have a better capacity to do other things under stress, even if you haven't directly trained those things. And the analogy he provides is paratroopers. So they're trained to cope with the stress of jumping out of a perfectly good airplane, and that helps them with the stress of combat on the ground.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've tried to introduce stress inoculation to our program for a while now at Janus General, and it's hard because people, they are very touchy-feely in the training world these days, and I've always been an advocate. You got to make people scared during their training with them, you know, being informed beforehand. You don't want to just bust out with this stuff, but you got to tell them, look, this is going to be cognitively intense. I might be screaming at you. I don't mean to, you know, make you feel bad or anything, but I want you to have the ability to perform when you are at a level of high stress-induced catecholes and everything surging through your system, because it will protect you in the real world. And it's a hard balance to strike, but I think we need to be striking it. I put an article on this in the show notes, but I think this is something we're not talking about enough, and I know if anyone's talking about it, it's you, Cliff.
Yeah, it's a good time for me to be discussing this because we've just finished a week of induction training for new helicopter doctors and paramedics. And we put 32 men and women through this training. And we warned them at the beginning of the week that, you know, we're going to start off fairly slow, but the simulations are going to get more stressful and very cognitively and emotionally demanding. And we make no apology for that. And it is a really, really fine line to walk because we don't want to break anybody. And the point is actually made in the book that it's very important that, you don't break people in the simulations. I'm trying to remember how it was actually worded at the point, but you know, it's got to be a positive experience for them, but we shouldn't pull any punches. We're preparing them for the real world. And what's stunningly apparent every time we run this is you can't predict how people are going to react. We'll take one doctor and paramedic team who are ostensibly identical on paper as another team, give them an identical situation. And one team will run that scenario, look at us at the end as if to say, well, when are you going to challenge us? Because it all went so smoothly. And the other team will turn it into a fairly shambolic event with escalating stress levels and loss of control of the patient and the environment and the team. No one could have predicted that, least of all the guys who are going through the simulation.
Definitely.
So it's the only way to prepare our teams is to put them through it.
And we could do a whole show on stress inoculation training, and maybe we will in the future. But the last part of this chapter I think worth discussing is Hick's Law, which says for every potential choice of ways to do something, your cognitive load, your task complexity dramatically rises. And they make a point in this book of saying that you should only have one way of doing things and only train in one way of doing things to minimize the chance of you effing it up when the stakes are high. And the example they give in the book is officers who used to use revolvers would train at the range of taking their expended brass, the things that were containing the actual bullet, and dropping them into their hands and putting them in their pockets. So after training, they wouldn't have to sweep up all their spent brass. And they noticed time after time during actual firefights, they would empty the brass into their hands and put it in their pocket at the expense of being able to rapidly reload and get back to dealing with the suspects. And so if you train with superfluous stuff, you will perform in real life with superfluous stuff. Though the example I thought of for resuscitation is I've fought my residents forever to not pre-flush the central lines. I've practiced now for 10 years as a actual attending. I've never had a central line actually fail. It's not to say it couldn't, and it just seems like a waste. But the real reason that I tell them not to pre-flush is when they need to do it quick, when they need to do it emergently, that is going to be a barrier to them doing it well, because the way you train is the way you perform in real life. And now you had, I think, even a better example of Hick's Law, Cliff.
Yeah, so you know, Hick's Law being that if you have more options, things just take longer. So we want to limit those options. our example is our pre-hospital rapid sequence intubation system. We've got emergency physicians and anaesthetists with many years of experience who work in our service. And it was initially an uphill struggle to convince them we wanted to do RSI one way. And over the last few years, we've increasingly limited the options available to them in how they do it. So we do it one way out and we train in one way. A nice example is that we don't provide multiple options for induction agents. We have ketamine. We don't just have ketamine. We have pre-drawn ketamine in a labeled syringe that's good to inject immediately. We have our pre-drawn neuromuscular blocker. So everything's good to go. It limits the options. But over the last few years, our scene times and our time to RSI has progressively decreased.
I love it. That's just perfect. Now, in the interest of time, Cliff, I think we're going to gloss over section two. I will just briefly describe the chapters we had read, but we won't discuss. Chapter one is about tunnel vision, the fact that when you get stressed, it's as if you're looking through a toilet paper tube. Read that one. Chapter two, autopilot, a whole bunch of stuff on how you train is how you perform in combat or resuscitation. So you have to make your training exactly how you want it done when you're stressed or else it's not going to work. Chapter three talks about time perception. And I think maybe, Cliff, let's just spend a minute or two on this because I think this is incredibly important. This is where I picked up and started talking about the idea that when we're stressed, we should not be squeezing a BVM because we have no ability to know how many breaths were given. Have you experienced the same thing, Cliff?
Absolutely. I've got video evidence of it as well in a team that I was running. Yeah, people go crazy with that bag. But in their own mind, their own experience, they're going fairly slowly. And this time distortion is something that's consistently experienced. And of course, it can go either way. Things can appear to slow down for you or speed up for you, depending on the cognitive space you're in and the training that you've had.
Definitely. Chapter four is on memory and the fact that you probably should not trust your memory if you were in these higher level conditions of stress and fear. And the reason I think that's a take-home message for us is that self-debriefing, going home and going over an incident and thinking you're doing good by yourself, probably not the best way. You probably should debrief with the other people there because everyone's memory is going to be a little suspect, but if you have a group share, you may be able to get closer to the truth of things and where things went right and things went wrong. What do you think?
Yeah, there's a great bit in the book where they talk about you imagine your worst case scenario, like your teammate being shot, and then you actually remember that happening because you imagined it so vividly. So our memory is really unreliable in these stressful situations. And it's a safety issue for the patient. The paramedic hands over to me in the emergency department that this patient's allergic to penicillin. I think, great, thanks for telling me. I know that now. But I will make a point of making someone write that on the board, telling the drugs nurse this patient is allergic to penicillin, you know, making sure the penicillin or penicillin-containing drugs are removed from that bed space because I know I will forget. Experience tells me my memory is so unreliable.
Definitely. Now, there's an entire section on here on training, and I think it's really applicable to anyone who does training, anyone who creates simulations. We don't have time to discuss it, but I think it's definitely worth a read. And I know you also like that section, correct, Cliff?
It was my favorite section.
Do you want to talk about? Do you have anything particular you wanted to talk about in that section?
Ah, man, there's so much. So just some great quotes to start with. In combat, you don't rise to the occasion. You sink to your level of training.
Oh, I love it.
So we can read the books. We can practice the procedures. We can delude ourselves that we can pull this off. But time and time again, simulation shows the more you put that trainee under stress, the less capable they'll be unless they have trained under stress. And the book contains some great examples of that. The other thing is about the training wears off, so conditioned reflexes have a half-life, and for some procedures you should perhaps train every 6 months. And we actually make our consultants, our specialists in pre-hospital care, do the RSI full currency training every 6 months for that reason.
That is perfect. Perfect. And now I think the last thing we're going to talk about may be worth the price of the book for anyone who has not been exposed to this in other areas of their life. And it's chapter 5 of section 4, and it's on tactical breathing, aka autogenic or combat breathing. And I know, Cliff, you and I had both been exposed to this in the martial arts, but just reading it and having a scientific basis for it, I think is game-changing. Do you want to describe what combat breathing is, Cliff?
Yeah, I mean, it's described in a fairly specific, regimented way in the book. I think, yeah, 4 seconds breath in, pause for four, out for four, something like that, which is one way of doing it. I think the specifics probably don't matter. It's more to me an element of mindfulness. It's being aware of the moment, aware of the situation, aware of your responses to that situation, and asserting control. And again, it's beautifully put in the book, but your breathing is your one autonomic function, your one automatic function that you can take active conscious control of. And if you do that, that has a knock-on effect to the other parts of your autonomic system that are potentially going haywire. So it gives you control. And again, it's something that we've been teaching for a while in our service, the cognitive and emotional overload to a new emergency or anesthetic resident registrar in the pre-hospital environment, their first big pre-hospital mission. We literally explain to them word for word to take a few seconds to get their stuff together, as we almost describe it, and to be conscious of their breathing and take a few short, slow, deep breaths. And what they find is that the tunnel vision goes away. They're no longer looking through that donut hole or that toilet roll tube. It expands their awareness. They feel more calm. They've got a better situational awareness.
Absolutely. Now I'm going to describe how they did describe it in the book, because for anyone who has not gone through martial arts training or meditation or yoga, this may be new, and the way they prescribe it is good enough for the use if you've not been exposed to other ways. But they describe basically 4 by 4 by 4 by 4 by 4, which means for 4 seconds, breathe in through your nose, and then hold that breath for 4 seconds, and then for 4 seconds, breathe out through your mouth, and then hold your exhalation without doing anything for 4 seconds, and do that 4 times. So 4 cycles, 4 seconds in, hold, 4 seconds, breathe out, 4 seconds, hold, 4 seconds. And doing that, just that, will have a dramatic effect on your autonomic nervous system, will take you from condition black to a lower condition where you're able to function better. And I was talking to a friend and who's actually in the Special Forces, and they are forced to get their heart rate greater than 200, and then they have to bring it down in 10 seconds or less in order to pass that exercise. And this is how they do it. What's your technique? If you just did have that conflict on the phone, and now your heart rate's revving up to 180, and now all of a sudden a resus comes in, what is your breathing method?
My breathing is very similar. I don't think I count the seconds, but I'll breathe in through the nose, I'll hold it, and I'll breathe out through the mouth, and I'll be actively aware of my breathing and trying to calm my own heart rate down.
They go further to say, and this is you mean this is drilled into you from day one in any martial arts training, you have to breathe into your belly. And this is to keep you from doing that dog panting breath that does really nothing good except exchange gas in your trachea. And your belly should actually expand with each of these breaths for this tactical breathing. And then you know you're doing it right. Cliff, did you have anything else in your notes you wanted to add from the book?
Yeah, some other concepts here. And again, so fantastically worded. He advises that we cleanse denial from our thinking. And when we're training for scenarios, we don't think if, when, we think when. So not if I'm in a can't oxygenate, can't ventilate situation, I'm going for a surgical airway. It's when I'm in a can't oxygenate, can't ventilate scenario, I'm going for a surgical airway. And that little change in wording creates a massive change in mindset and is more likely to help you make things happen.
Beautiful. So would you recommend people read the book, Cliff?
I would. And for the pacifist amongst us, who aren't particularly interested in the literal physical combat side of things, I would just ask you to park that. This is a book about human performance under stress. That's all it is. And the best examples of those in human history come from warfare. But if you're an emergency physician, an emergency nurse, a paramedic, anyone involved in critical care, these concepts apply just as much to you as they do to someone out there protecting our nations on the battlefield. So I thoroughly recommend the book, and thanks again, Scott, for recommending it to me.
Well, I can't add anything better than that, so I think we will stop there. Thank you, folks, for joining us on the first ever MCRIT Book Club on the book On Combat by Dave Grossman. I was joined by Cliff Reed, master resuscitationist, rage podcaster, and the creator of resus.me. Thanks, Cliff.
Thank you, mate. Bye, everyone.